In Ezra chapter 2, we have many names. There are some parts of the world where, and some parts of the world even known to us, where there is perhaps a hint of something similar to what we have in Ezra chapter 2. There are places in the world where there is something much closer to this. I heard of a man in some tribal community. I didn't register precisely where it was. It was perhaps in Africa or somewhere like New Guinea, a tribal community. And there were people who had gone there to translate the Bible. Usually that translation begins with the New Testament. And along the way, he had also heard preachers preaching the gospel of Christ about what Jesus had done and about the call of Jesus to men to trust in him. This man, one day, his missionary friend read Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1, which begins with a number of generations of the genealogy of Jesus, going back to Adam. His friend, the missionary, read every verse, every word, every name, the Father or the Son, and so on. And the native man, his eyes lit up, and he said, "Now I believe. I can see that Jesus was a real man. He has a family line. He belongs. He came from somewhere. Jesus didn't just appear. He wasn't just out of nowhere." For many cultures, such names as these are crucial. Perhaps they ought to have read Ezra right through. But at the very least, we are, I think, to be pulled up to scan through those names, to dwell on the fact of those names. And we're pulled up short to consider why the story that Ezra tells is told in this way, rather than, as we might do in our Western culture, just getting on with the story. Why does it work out this way, where chapter 1, which seems to be momentous, where one of the greatest kings of all time, most powerful king, Cyrus, has a proclamation to make which revives a nation? Why it takes 11 verses in our reading, in our translation? King's proclamation. The king allocates the riches to the people, and the people return to their own land after many years in exile. Quite possibly the very barest details were recorded, and that's all that Ezra, or whoever the historian was who compiled this, perhaps that's all he had, and that might be instructive in the same way. Later on, Ezra does tell us more detail, which he went through himself, preparing for his journey. There is a bit more flesh on that story, we might say. But not in chapter 1. Then chapter 2 we turn to, and yes, a number of the verses are much shorter, but we have 70 verses, of which over 60 are filled with names. Names and their numbers. It's not the way that we tend to cope very well with history. It's important for the historian. It's evidence. It's raw data. And it's very important to the people who are named and their families who are numbered. But it's not the way that we're accustomed to thinking about things, perhaps. We are of a people that usually has something to say about a list of names like this, and then we avoid them. But it's the relative weight that is given to the two sets of information that we have in chapter 1, and the captives were brought from Babylon to Jerusalem. It finishes. Enough, that's what's happened. But who are they? And then it's filled out in such great detail. And it should raise a question, why is this? What's behind it? Is it just that this was a cultural thing? Or was the culture actually determined by something deeper? What is it that warrants putting aside and not just not including in the record a lot of the other things that we might be looking for in a story of migration? What about the months that they would have spent on the road? And a very dangerous road it was as well. What's the message behind this? And there are, in this chapter, valuable things to learn from, and I would put it this way, first of all, the families and places, and that's really, you might say, the first part of the chapter, first half of the chapter. Really, it is. The 70 verses, verses 1 to 35, I'm calling the families and places, and then we take up from the priests and the Levites, primarily, in the second part of the chapter. And so, first of all, the families and places. The whole matter, I think, is introduced in summary in verse 1, where it tells us at the end of that verse that those who return to Jerusalem and Judah, everyone to his own city. And that's a key part of what Ezra is getting at as we read here. It's that that is then laid out in more detail. Although even then it's not complete, but there is more detail. And I think perhaps there is something of a style twist partway through that highlights the point that I'm making. So we have that summary statement, they return to Jerusalem and Judah, everyone to his own city. The next verse introduces Zerubbabel to us, and he is one who features repeatedly in this period. He features again later. He especially appears in the prophets Haggai and Zechariah alongside Jeshua, who is the second name in verse 2, who is the high priest of the time. Zerubbabel was a prince of the family of David. So he was a natural leader, you might say, amongst that in that nation. And Jeshua, or Joshua, was appropriately also a very significant character as the high priest. And it's from there that we find a great list of names. There are a couple that you might recognize, but they're not likely to be the people who you recognize. Nehemiah, for example, here in this setting, and this timing is not the one of the whose name is on the following book. That was a governor at a later period. Mordecai is also unlikely to be the uncle of Esther that we read of in that book. Again, the timing doesn't match, nor does the stories. Mordecai here returned to Judah and Jerusalem, and that's to be expected. But there was more than one person with these names. For example, we've seen Jeshua, which is the same as Joshua, perhaps quite likely named after the great Joshua who followed Moses as the leader of the people. But that's just a little bit behind, a bit of background that to remember as we go on, and as you do come through the various names that are listed here. In general terms, the first section of this chapter seems to follow the line where most of the first names, for example, the people of Parosh in verse 3, seem to be names of people or fathers of these houses. They're the names of men and their families. So the people of Parosh, 2,172. So Parosh himself would have been one of the names perhaps who left or was even living in Jerusalem before the exile, given the time span that we're looking at. But it was that extended family that came under his name. And then as we read through going a little bit further, you come to what is very clearly a place name in verse 21, the people of Bethlehem, a name that you're familiar with, 123. And many of the following names are names of places. In verse 25, Kirjath Arim, or that is the same as we read elsewhere of Kiriath Jearim, who, if you remember many of the stories of the judges and kings and so on, the early kings especially, that name appears. The people of Ramah in verse 26 is a familiar name from other places too. So you have names of men, fathers of households, and you have names of places or cities. Now take yourself back there for a moment to that particular period and what has led up to it, and realize that it was so important for the people of that time to have a claim to a place in the land. They were going back to the land. Where would they go to, more precisely? That's what verse 2 is talking about, everyone to his own city. Now these were people who could trace their line back. If you belong to a family that has 2,172 people in it, that's going back quite a number of generations. So they're interested in those generations, and therefore they are interested in the place that those people, their father came from. You have the name of the man and of the place, and those places were to be eternal inheritance given in the days of Joshua, as the land was allocated to the various tribes. It was mapped out in detail by Joshua, because God had made a covenant with the nation to give them the land. And as he gave the covenant to the nation as a whole for the whole land, it was also in terms where each family was given a part of the land. It was in terms of God, of an eternal inheritance. It was God's covenant with them, with their family. And that God's covenant with that family still prevailed. He made that covenant blessing to them. It was to be held in perpetuity. And when an exile interrupted, and yet they were able to come back to the land, where would they go but to look for the place that they had come from? They'd been uprooted several generations earlier. They were going back to Israel, to Judah. What provision would be there for them? The city of Jerusalem was an obvious objective. But that was not all. The families were to be acknowledged. It wasn't just a lump of people to go and to find their own place. But they went back, they checked the records, and they were able to find precisely where they had come from. And so whether it was the fathers or the cities, and I've given a general division, there is a mixture. And many of the names of the places would have come from the original settlers in those places, and so would have a name of a father as well. That's where they got the name from. They were coming back home. And one of them that I find especially exciting is in verse 23. Yeah, it's good to be excited by things like this. The men of Anathoth, 128. I wonder if you know anything about Anathoth. In Jeremiah chapter 32, he tells a story. Jeremiah tells how he had been prophesying. He was, remember, coming up to the point, and he was mixed up with the whole mess of the last days of Jerusalem when the Babylonians first came and eventually obliterated the place. And then in chapter 32, and if you have headings, you'll see the heading is most likely something like Jeremiah buys a field. But he does this under God's instruction. God tells him, partway through the chapter, says, your uncle Hanameel is going to come, or the son of your uncle is going to come and ask you to buy his field. Now why would he be doing that? He would be doing it because he could see the the destruction that was on the horizon. He could see the trouble that was coming. So a field was no use to him, but money might have been. So he asked Jeremiah, will you redeem this field? Now that wouldn't make sense. Jeremiah knew better than anyone the destruction that was coming. Who would be able to enjoy that field? Who would be able to work that field? No one. The story eventually is that Jeremiah himself was taken to Egypt, the other direction. But God says you must buy it. And it was to be an acted prophecy. Because God later on, further down, he explains why. Jeremiah asks him why. And the answer is, you're going to buy this field because it will be a demonstration by my servant that my people are coming back. That there will be a use for that field that belongs to your family. Anathoth, the men of Anathoth came back. There's a fulfillment of prophecy, the prophecy of Jeremiah. It's an exciting thing. When Judah's light was dying, everyone else was giving up hope for the land. God gave his direction to Jeremiah to buy the field because he was going to bring back the people from captivity. The word had gone out. It was a little bit before that, chapter 29, we noticed already last time, where the promise was made that after 70 years I will bring you back. Well, how do we know? How do we know that's going to happen? God says, I'm going to get my prophet to buy a field to prove that it's going to happen. And you see the fulfillment of it in that one little verse that we might otherwise shoot over, Anathoth. How many other names had that same similar kind of meaning to the people involved? And when God made that promise to Jeremiah, included in that was a repetition of what I've come to think over the years is perhaps at the heart of every covenant renewal. He said, they shall be my people, and I will be their God. Ezra chapter 2, verse 23 says, they are my people. I am their God. That's signified and implied by those very words. Men did come back to Anathoth. Perhaps a note here regarding numbers. It's something to do with the way that we read the Bible. The numbers, if you were interested in the arithmetic and you were to go down and just tot up those numbers of the men of this place and of that family and so on, you wouldn't get the same answer. The total, the whole congregation together in verse 64, it was 42,360. The total which I've just lifted from elsewhere comes out to something like 29,000. So there's some kind of shortfall, it would have seemed. But that doesn't need to be a problem. You get a similar thing in chapter 1 regarding the articles of from the treasury. There are some that are specified, and then the articles are summarized in verse 11, 5,400. The numbers don't match up. But that doesn't need to be a problem. I think it's, we do this frequently, I think, in one way or another. It's along the lines of where you might be talking about a large group, but you say it's made up of other significant groups. Let's say there's 50% are, let's say in our culture, 50% are white, there's another 20% who are Asian, and so on. But there's always a number that you just put together as because they're small, much smaller groups and too difficult to itemize. Some numbers seem more noteworthy, and I think that's what you have in the families that are listed there. You do also find that there are possibly others who tagged along and could not be named or listed in the same way. And then you would say, well, and there were a number of others as well. And they finish up. The reason you have the total number is because the simple addition of the others doesn't give you the full picture. And then to notice as well that when you put together verse 64 and verse 65, the totals there come to just short of 50,000 people. It's not a great number to resettle the land, certainly compared with the a comparable event in Israel's history, in the Exodus, when they came first to take over the land. Now, having talked about the families and the places that come together and to demonstrate that God was keeping his covenant and restoring the families to their historic inheritance, we must also take account of the priests and the Levites, and they take up a considerable portion of the chapter. The others are listed separately, and we did read them, we highlighted them as we went through. Verse 36, the priests, through to verse 39, then 40 is the Levites, 41 the singers, the sons of Asaph, and go back to Chronicles and you'll see how this particular body was established by David. Then the sons of the gatekeepers, then the Nethinim in verse 43, and then Solomon's servants in verse, or the sons of Solomon's servants in verse 55. There are others too in verse 59. It's not clear whether this is just a general group. You could not find their genealogy, the list that goes back, their family tree, because it seems to flow into the particular reference to the sons of the priests, some who could not find their listing either in verse 62, and as a result they had to remain outside, in almost in suspension, if you like, until they could clarify their position serving as priests. So the first part, I would suggest, reminds us how important it was that the covenant blessing of inheritance should be reclaimed. The other key strand in their return to Judah was the revival of the worship of the Lord. That is what the Spirit had stirred Cyrus himself to instigate. And it was a priority for them, both because the great king of Persia had directed it, but also because it was, as we read in Psalm 137, a great anguish of soul to the family, or to the people, that they were apart from the holy city of God, where they understood his worship was especially to be fulfilled. And so they needed to revive this worship, and that is why the great specification of the families of the priests, the sons of Jeshua and so on, and the Levites and other servants of the temple. It looks a little bit topsy-turvy. Through history, the priests have been one family out of the whole tribe of Levi. But if you look at the numbers here, there were all of 74 Levites who were ready to go back, and there were over 4,000 priests in the various families. So there's something unusual here, and if you study, go and check out what others have suggested about this, it might be that the work of the Levites was far less glamorous than that of the priests. They had to do the hard work, and maybe it didn't appeal quite so much. The other thing about the priests was that they didn't have the same kind of inheritance as the other people did. They were scattered around the cities of Israel, and had to come to Jerusalem to serve, and maybe that was less attractive as well. We're not sure, but it is something that is quite striking when you do look at the numbers. There was also recognition given to the temple worship. The singers indicate that. Gatekeepers, both of the city and of the temple. The Nethinim appear to be servants, especially related to the temple, as were, it would seem, the sons of Solomon's servants. Solomon, almost being shorthand for the great temple that he erected. The Nethinim, as temple servants, are likely to have come from outside of Israel. They were servants of the Israelites, it seems. But amongst them all, it's to do with the reinstitution of worship of the Lord, again as required by Cyrus. The emphasis on that and the importance of it, I think, is highlighted when you do dwell for a moment on those who could not be found in the list of priests in the genealogy. They were therefore excluded from the priesthood as defiled. Worship needed to be right, needed to be true, needed to be pure. Only the Urim and Thummim could give the necessary response to clarify their position. And that's the first time that these Urim and Thummim have been mentioned for hundreds of years. No one is quite sure, I don't think, what they were, but it seems to be two objects that were held by the high priest that were used in some way. It was God's appointed way for men to learn the will, his will, God's will, on an otherwise obscure matter. And this was the only way that could be perceived, by which these men who had no trace behind them, how can we decide whether they are suitable for this work or not? But that highlights the necessity for the priesthood to be kept pure, to be as appointed by God himself. And that should take us back as well to the whole story of Israel. Because so often we learn, and one of the great things that the prophets spoke about was the failing priesthood. If the priests had been true all the years of the nation of Israel, it might be said that there would be no need for the prophets and the kings. They would be the intermediaries. They would be the ones who would take God's word to the people and take the people's worship to God. There was a time when the kingdom split, and in the northern kingdom there was a garbled version of the worship that had been part of Israel for many years. And Jeroboam, the first king there, he appointed his own priests, and they did not come from the tribe of the Levites, even far less from the family of Aaron, the priestly family. They were taken from any tribe and nation. That was not the way that God had appointed, and that whole worship failed abysmally. But then too, the priests at the temple in Jerusalem had often been faithless as well, which led eventually to that downfall of the people. And so we see in this chapter that the covenant blessing of the land was restored to them. But that covenant blessing of the land was always contingent, dependent on their obedience, the obedience of the people. Would they go on living in the sight of God and remembering that he had given them that land? In doing so, worshipping him. Before they ever moved into the land, Moses warned them that they would lose the land if they began to forget God himself and to therefore go into sin and to serve other gods and to be proud in themselves. They would lose the land, and that's exactly what happened. The exile into Babylon was simply an application of that long-standing promise. That was the only reason that God and the prophets offered when the people did, in the end, lose the land. That's why, the very same reason that had been established so many years before. So now that they've returned, after people like Daniel prayed and confessed the sins of the people, God did return them, according to his promise. The same promise still applies. You will be here, you will be blessed, you'll be kept in the land if you serve the one true God. Now that they've returned, surely they will do all that they can to make sure it won't happen again. That's why true worship of God had to be raised. Not just because Cyrus said it. That was the least of the things, but it must be raised again in Jerusalem for God's covenant to be upheld. And it's for that reason that the priesthood was also so important. So what's the point of the names and the numbers here? It is about covenant and their covenant God. It presents the evidence that yet again, what God said by his prophets was sure, that God does keep his covenant. There has always been a call on men in that covenant, call on men to believe and to go on believing. And for that reason, worship is vital and must be held in holiness. And perhaps I should just also remark on the remaining verses of this chapter, something slightly different, where it tells us of the heads, some of the heads of the fathers' houses, and the giving that they made for the treasury and for the priestly garments for the worship of God. Very reminiscent of the Sinai experience, where the instructions were given for constructing the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, and the people were so liberal with their givings that they had to call a halt to it. This time it's nothing like the same volume, but it is according to their ability. It was out of the thanksgiving of their hearts, thankful for God delivering them from that strange land, bringing them into the land of covenant, of promise, and of peace. It's so much like the events of the Exodus, so much smaller, but it was Zechariah in this very time who prophesied, "It's not by might or by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord." And that was a word to the prince, the leader, Zerubbabel. So we read Ezra chapter 2. We've skipped over the journey. If there were any adventures on that several-month journey between Babylon and Jerusalem, you'll have to depend on the historical novelists. We don't have it in the Bible, because the Bible has a purpose, and I think it can be well highlighted and distilled in these few things that we've recognized in this chapter. This chapter has God setting down and demonstrating the ways that he's been at work to maintain his covenant. It's his covenant. He brought them back to the land. He would establish them again in the land. But they were also called to be obedient. And that was all ultimately for the purpose. It's leading in one direction. He was not going to forsake that covenant, because out of these few covenant people, he was going to bring forth the one who was a priest, the one who would complete and would uphold that covenant, who would bring about the true worship of God, and through him that God would extend the blessing even beyond the land to all the nations. A very small group, but still enough that God should do his work. The hundreds of thousands who left Egypt could not keep that covenant on man's side, but God did continue as their Savior frequently through judges and the kings. The kings could not keep it, but God was patient towards them for so long, even though they led his people astray so much. It did mean that the time came when the people should be removed from their precious land. And the test would they then turn and look to the one who had given it to them? We're so much inclined to get absorbed with the gift and forget the giver. And this tells us that only a remnant could be found. Levi perhaps warrants a bit more meditation. They were the ones who at Sinai devoted themselves to God and kept themselves holy from the false worship. But here, very few had an interest in returning. Only a remnant could be found, for this time at least. So what could they do, these few people? Well, they could obey. That's what Ezra was was diligent with. That's how Ezra served. That's how Nehemiah served. That's how Haggai and Zechariah served, and Malachi as well, a little while later, to hold the people to the covenant principles that God had set down. Would they obey? Would they serve? Would they worship? This tells us that they were being set up so that they could. Would they? We also, I think, have a demonstration once more that this is divine history. It will always be different from others, but it tells us that God's plan is irresistible. It's His work. Man is weak, but God is at work. And for that, through that, we too have a call today to put our trust in Him. His word doesn't fail. Remember Anathoth on the field, that the people of Anathoth could return to, seeking God's blessing on His word. Let us pray together.